Everything was quiet, but it was too quiet. There was an eerie feeling that something was brewing. I decided that we were on the eve of big events, and I made a beeline to the Smalley Institute, once the fashionable college for young ladies, now the headquarters of the Petrograd Soviet. In the Bolshevik Party headquarters, there I saw Lenin, pacing up and down, with eyes on the ground, engaged in deep thought. As I hurried to the hall where the city Soviet was to meet, I met John Reed, the American journalist who wrote that book, 10 Days That Shook the World. We went in together, the only Anglo-Saxons present at that famous gathering. Delegates of workers from the factories and soldiers of the garrison had met together to decide if they would sweep away the weak liberal government that had followed the disappearance of the Romanovs and set up a revolutionary government of workers and peasants. On the platform I saw Sverdlov, the chairman, and Lenin and Trotsky. I don't remember seeing Stalin. He was probably working behind the scenes. From what I can remember, I think Lenin spoke first. But the impression on my mind was that he was rather hesitant. A critical moment had arrived. No one knew which way things were going. Then some dispatch rider arrived with news. The Red Sailors from Kronstadt had brought a warship up Geneva, and with the garrison had occupied the Winter Palace without a struggle, and had arrested the government. I raced off to the Winter Palace, but long lines of red soldiers kept me out that night. So I went there next morning. There I saw the cruiser Aurora, moored in midstream. She had put a shell through one of the palace walls, but that was all the sign of battle I could see. The revolution, at least in Petrograd, was practically bloodless.
The first time I went round to see him as he was addressing the crowd in the Kaczynski Palace. And I was rather disappointed because he looked rather an insignificant little man in a very badly fitting suit. And he was walking up and down the balcony, sort of speaking in a very kind of flat voice. And yet, there was something in his voice, sort of controlled passion that seemed to communicate itself to the crowd because they got very worked up.
Comrades of the Red Army, the capitalists of England, America, and France are waging war against Russia. They are avenging themselves on the Soviet Republic of workers and peasants for having overthrown the landowners and capitalists, thus setting the whole world an example. The capitalists of England, France, and America are aiding and abetting the Russian landowners with money and military supplies. They, in turn, are mounting an attack against Soviet power from Siberia, the Don, and the Northern Caucasus in an attempt to restore the Tsar, the landowners, and the capitalists to power. But no, that shall not be.
Now, you say he was the number one person, the only person who counted in the Soviet Union. You got the firm impression that he was absolutely in control of the situation.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. I mean, there was no such thing as the rule of collectivity at that time. It was the cult of the individual with a vengeance. Of course, he was extremely clever because he played off one against the other, the armed forces, the party, the bureaucracy. He played them off one against the other, and with his occasional purges and so on, he kept himself in power, in absolute power.
Did he seem to you to be a brutal and coarse man?
No, I wouldn't say brutal, and certainly not coarse. On the contrary, I would say that his manners were almost refined. And I wouldn't say the word, at any rate, at that time, I wouldn't have used the word brutal, but he certainly struck me as a very strong man, strong to the point of ruthlessness. I mean, perhaps the most memorable thing he told me was this. He said, "Mr. Ambassador, our peasant is a simple man, but wise. When he sees a wolf, he shoots it. He doesn't preach morals to the wolf. He shoots it, and the wolf knows it and behaves accordingly."
The trial of the counter-revolutionary Trotsky wrecking group in the Kemerovo mines is over. The proletarian court has passed its severe and only possible sentence. All 9 defendants were sentenced to death. The Trotskyites and fascists, the spies and subversive agents organized in Kemerovo, murderers of workers under the leadership of the Trotskyist secret group. Their sinister designs succeeded only in part. The explosion did take place in the mine. Work was interrupted for a certain time, and 12 miners were killed. But the further activity of the enemies of the people was prevented by the organs of the People's Commissariat for Home Affairs.
In Stalingrad, everyone lives underground, simply because there's nowhere else to live. From a distance, you might think the factories were still working. But as you get nearer, you see that the chimneys are shot through with shells and that the factories themselves are utterly destroyed. I've seen some destruction in the past year or two, but never anything more complete than that at the great Red October steelworks, where the last battles were fought before the final German surrender. It's just a desolation of tortured metal and broken brickwork, which for months has provided defense lines for both sides. Every yard of it, literally every yard, has been fought over, and frozen corpses still lie among the wreckage of trenches and dugouts and blasted walls. Stalingrad itself has ceased to exist. In a long inspection of the city, which not so long ago housed more than 500,000 people, I didn't see a single brick or stone building which wasn't just an empty shell.
The chief of the escort recited the morning prayer, which every prisoner was heartily sick of. "Attention, prisoners! Marching orders must be strictly obeyed. Keep to your ranks. No hurrying. Keep a steady pace. No talking. Keep your eyes fixed ahead and your hands behind your backs. Step to the right or left is considered an attempt to escape, and the escort has orders to shoot without warning. Leading guards, quick, march!" The two guards in the lead of the escort must have set out along the road. The column heaved forward, shoulders swaying, and the escorts, some 20 paces to the right and left of the column, each man at a distance of 10 paces from the next, Tommy guns at the ready, set off too. It hadn't snowed for a week, and the road was worn hard and smooth. They skirted the camp, and the wind caught their faces sideways. Hands clasped behind their backs, heads lowered, the column of prisoners moved on as though at a funeral. All you saw was the feet of 2 or 3 men ahead of you and the patch of trodden ground where your own feet were stepping. From time to time, one of the escorts would cry, "U-48, hands behind back," or "B-502, keep up." But they shouted less and less. The slashing wind made it difficult to see, and the guards weren't allowed to tie cloth over their faces. Theirs wasn't much of a job either. In warmer weather, everybody in the column talked, no matter how much the escort might shout at them. But today, every prisoner hunched his shoulders, hid behind the back of the man in front of him, and plunged into his own thoughts. The thoughts of a prisoner. They're not free either. They keep returning to the same things. A single idea keeps stirring. Would they feel that piece of bread in the mattress? Would he have any luck at the sickbay that evening? Would they put Buinovsky in the cells? And how did Cesar get his hands on that warm vest? He'd probably greased a palm or two in the store for private people's belongings. How else? Because he had breakfasted without bread and eaten his food cold, Shukhov's belly felt unsatisfied that morning, and to prevent it complaining and begging for food, he stopped thinking about the camp and let his mind dwell on the letter he'd soon be writing home. The column passed the wood processing factory, built by prison labor, the workers' settlement, the huts had been assembled by prisoners too, but the inhabitants were civilians, the new club, convict built in entirety from the foundations to the mural decorations, but it wasn't they who saw the films there, and then moved out into the steppe, straight into the wind, heading for the reddening dawn. Bare white snow stretched to the horizon, to the left, to the right, and not a single tree could be seen on the whole expanse of steppe. A new year, 1951, had begun, and Shukhov had the right to two letters that year. He had sent his last letter in July and got an answer to it in October. At Ust-Izhma, the rules had been different. You could write once a month. But what was the sense of writing?
How different as a personality type he is from most of the communist leaders who have been met in the West. This extreme ebullience, this outgoing nature, and I think a genuine faith which he has in liberating the springs of initiative in the individual, I would say separate him tremendously from most of his predecessors.
Externally, my image turned out to be correct, of a rather round, bouncy, energetic man, very much the politician, with his tongue with a safety catch off it, and with what he imagined to be, indeed generally was, the right word for the right person at the right moment.
His formation, his intellectual formation, his education is an entirely Marxist one. He may have had some sort of village schooling, probably didn't extend to the point of teaching to read or write, but when he began to be educated, and particularly when he began to be politically educated and to take politics seriously, this was only when he went to a party school after he was grown up in his early 20s.
There's one very simple guiding motive. That is, he wants to do everything he can for Soviet Russia, and he doesn't care tuppence about anybody else, which, of course, is a reasonable attitude.
Well, the concept of the private car is something rather Western, I think. More and more people are getting their private cars in the Soviet Union, and the big Fiat factory, which is being built on the Volga, will eventually produce lots of cars, but this is jam tomorrow. In terms of cars, there is no jam today. They're very expensive to get. Second-hand cars are in great demand. The one car sale room in Moscow, for example, there are hundreds and hundreds of people on the waiting list for a car, and your name comes on the list, and they send you a postcard and say, there's a car ready for you. You go along, and you have to take the car that's there. There is no saying, no, I don't like this car, I prefer to have another one. You take the car that's there, or your name goes down to the bottom of the list again, and it may be months, if not years, before your name comes up again.
But what about, for example, other consumer goods that the Russians can't get, that we here in the West can get?
In terms of durable goods, in terms of, say, a refrigerator, it may mean a journey to Leningrad, because you may hear that the refrigerators available in Leningrad when they're not in Moscow. So you have to shop around, you have to keep your spying network, to coin a phrase, open to your friends, and they tell you what is available, where, and when.
At about 10 or 11 o'clock, the first fighting began to reach us, and everyone began to take cover, and the streets were completely deserted. The Russian drivers would drive up and down the main streets in top gear at about 20 miles an hour, fighting, shooting their cannons and their machine guns at wherever they saw movements. This meant, in fact, that the freedom fighters didn't suffer too many casualties because the shooting was vastly inaccurate, but that the houses did suffer a great deal. Also, the freedom fighters had laid down plates full of earth on some of the streets which looked like mines, and this again held up most of the Russian tanks. And in fact, I don't think the Russians attempted to go across these mines, until the Monday night when they got out on foot to inspect them and found, in fact, that for 2 days they'd been fooled. While all this were happening, the civilians were mainly, or the fighters, in fact, and really everyone was a fighter, were in the first and second floors, and they were firing at the tanks with small arms fire, which was ineffective, but designed to keep the tank's armor down, which it did do, while others could much more safely throw Molotov cocktails at the exhaust pipes, which were about 3 or 4 feet long and coming out of the sides and at the top, so more easily able to be hit.
Were there any children and women amongst the freedom fighters?
Yes, we saw one little boy, age 12, I spoke to. He was wandering around with a Tommy gun over his shoulder and seemed to be absolutely impervious to what was going on, but quite prepared to fight against the Russians, and even if he was killed. Another thing about this little boy is he didn't want his parents to know that he was fighting, and so he used to keep his rifle in the hotel, his Tommy gun, and come and collect it.
When West Berliners woke up this morning, East German People's Police had already been at work for several hours digging up roads and erecting barriers so as to reduce the more than 80 crossing points between the Western and Soviet sectors of the city to 13. The new restrictions are clearly directed against the refugees from East Germany who have been pouring into West Berlin in greatly increased numbers recently. Road crossings into West Berlin are all controlled now, and the underground and overhead railways which used to run on from East Berlin into West Berlin now stop at the last station in the Soviet sector and turn back. Yesterday, over 2,400 refugees were registered at the main West Berlin reception camp. So far today, a mere handful have got through by creeping through backyards or bridges not yet sealed off, or by swimming canals.
They calculate so far that not many more than 200 or so of the refugees now reporting managed to cross the line after the new stringent measures came into force. Some of these made quite dramatic escapes. For example, a man, his wife and two children, swam the canal in the night. The husband supported their three-year-old child on his shoulders. An eight-year-old, a little girl, swam as best she could between her parents, but was nearly exhausted by the effort and was only just dragged to safety on the western bank before her strength failed.
You are listening to the Legal Free radio station here in Kralove, Czechoslovakia. We appeal to all radio stations in Romania, Yugoslavia. Please inform about the situation in the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic. Please transmit all calls in Romanian, Polish, German, Hungarian, Bulgarian, French, English, Italian, and others. You, Romanians and Yugoslavians, you are the only ones who stand by our side. Please, let the whole world know the truth.
We have here two most pronounced responses to the war. One is made by a large majority of Americans. It is that Britain and France are right and that Hitlerism is wrong. That is the judgment, or even more, the conviction, indeed a profound conviction, of most Americans. At the same time, most Americans, an even larger majority, are determined that America should stay out of the war. That determination is, I think, the strongest idea in American life today. And since that is true, I think it needs to be faced and evaluated. Having said that most people are in profound sympathy with the British and French cause, the determination not to go to war can't be a determination not to be fighting on the side of Britain and France. It's something else. It's a loathing of war, first of all, and a loathing of being involved in a European war, and indeed a war a long way from this country. Obviously, it's a feeling that arises from a sense of security.
At the time of the explosion, we were wearing Polaroid welder's glasses. They were so dark that even the tropical sun showed through them as nothing more than a vague pinpoint of light. Even then, the explosion, when eventually it came, was so bright that it had the same effect as if night had been turned into day. A few seconds later, when it was safe to take off our glasses, we looked out towards the target and saw a vast ball of fire. It was about 2,000 feet in the air and half a mile in diameter. This fire, which generated almost 10 million degrees of heat, began rocketing up into the heavens at a speed of something like 20,000 feet a minute. After 15 seconds, the flame had died out and turned into a cloud. Exactly what that cloud looked like, I do not suppose any words will ever describe. Unlike any other phenomenon the world has ever seen, it was possessed of some diabolical activity, as though it were a horrible form of life.
The work of flying food and essential supplies into Gatow Airport has got properly into its stride now. Royal Air Force men and men of the RASC have been flown in from all parts, and the whole traffic system of the airfield has been altered to accommodate the new demand on it. The chief supplies are flour, meat and vegetables, milk, sugar, potatoes, and meat gravy. While one aircraft is landing them, another is circling the airfield preparing to land, and yet another is a black speck, rapidly becoming bigger, against the grey sky over the pine trees. Pine trees, of course, in the Russian zone.
3 miles to the runway, coming down very nicely. Continue on your course at 265. Bring you in very nicely indeed. Nice approach. 2.5 miles to go. Turn left, left 3 degrees, left, left 3 degrees, near 262. Start to lose altitude at the rate of 600 feet a minute.
Marches north to a POW camp, Chong Song, and there they started indoctrinations, and it was compulsory. They said it was free. It was in a democratic country. It was free of speech, and you could do what you wanted. You didn't have to study, but if you didn't study, then you was they took you as being of a hostile attitude. So yes. A hostile attitude towards the three people of the world, and you'd be punished. So yes. It was you had no alternative but to string along with them or not, and if you didn't, you'd end up in jail. Well, I ended up in jail, and they tried to make me, they said I was a member of the escape committee, and I'd been spreading anti-communism in the POW camp, causing friction between the men and the administration of the camp, and I had to confess. Well, I told them I wasn't guilty of any of those crimes, I was just carrying on minding my own business.
Yes.
So they insisted that I confess. So I wrote, they told me to write. Persistently said, right. So I got browned off and I said, okay, I'll write. So I wrote a story about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And
what did they think about that?
Well, they wasn't amused like I was. And I smoked half a packet of cigarettes too, and they didn't like that neither. And they strung me up in one of the rooms with a rope around my wrists, my hands behind my back, and strung me to the ceiling. And then they tied my leg up behind my back and the rope around my neck, so that if I lowered my leg, I'd strangle myself. They left me there for quite some time, and then they released me down, brought me down, and just left me in the handcuffs. And then I thought, well, if they're going to beat you up like this, there's going to be no limit to what they are eventually going to do to you. So I thought I might as well escape.
These people over here need help bad.
That's about it. Came over to fight for the people. It sounds corny, but that's just what it amounts to.
What's your view about killing somebody in a battle?
Oh, in combat, I have no feelings toward it. I wouldn't have no feelings toward it. I mean, I haven't shot anybody yet, but if the time comes, then I will do it.
I just assume kill a child over here because the child goes up to be a VC, and it isn't their fault indirectly, but...
Well, you wouldn't mind killing children?
Oh, I mind killing a child. I feel funny about it, but... That child is going to grow up to kill my children someday. So if I was told, shoot that child, I'd shoot him.
Mr. Gordon Walker, how many countries did you find sympathetic towards the United States cause in South Vietnam?
Malaysia, including Singapore, Thailand, Laos, and of course South Vietnam, the government of Saigon, were all very strongly and staunchly with the Americans, supported what the Americans were doing. I think there is danger of alienating Asian opinion a bit further away, whether it is in India or Pakistan or Japan. Further away, I think, where you're less closely involved with the immediate prospects that, say, China might take over South Vietnam. The further you get away from the cauldron, the greater is the danger that America is alienating Asian opinion, but not right near the middle of the fighting. Although Asians may not like each other and are perfectly prepared to quarrel and even fight on occasion, they don't want white men there supporting one lot of them against another. And I think this is one of the great truths about the whole Vietnam situation.